a great chance you should be thrilled.
Thrilled? There could be a death penalty.
Not for the lawyer.
Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer.
Ladytrons and Gentlebots.
Objection. In the absence of pants, defense and suspenders serve no purpose.
I'm going to allow them for now.
Thank you.
I may be a simple country apple chicken, but I know when we're finger-licked. What do you say we plead insanity?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 29 coming at you for a second time this week. How exciting is that? How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
Doing good. Well, let's celebrate it right now. We hit our Patreon goal. let's also give you credit for yet another prediction that you were correct on. You predicted that we would hit this goal very soon. I forget your exact prediction, but whatever it was right. We hit our goal on patreon.com/law to do 2 episodes a week. How cool is that?
Yeah, I'm really excited. Also, slightly terrified. but this is fantastic. I think all of our listeners know about your change to your schedule, Thomas, which is really what's going to make it possible for us to do this twice a week.
Yeah. I did say we set this as a stretch goal, and I told Andrew, there is no way I'm doing 2 episodes a week of this until I quit my job. Well, good news, everybody. I am quitting my job very soon. So this will start in January. That may sound weird because there's 2 episodes this week, but this is just the one odd week. It will start in January. We will have 2 episodes every week. And as such, we're going to do Thomas Takes the Bar once a week. We won't do it in every episode because I think that would be a little too much and it wouldn't maybe give people time to think about it and respond on Twitter and all that. So one of our episodes will have that as our segments, and the other one will have our normal kind of question segments, breaking down the law, all that stuff. And I love that because it allows us to take more time on Thomas Takes the Bar, because frankly, I've been wanting to ask more follow-up questions and go into the issues more, but we've been a little pressed for time. So I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, me too. The segment's gone over well. I think a lot of people are interested in it.
Yeah, no, it's been really fun. You know what? The excitement doesn't stop because this episode features our first guest that we've ever had. Later on in the show, you'll hear Tom and Cecil from Cognitive Dissonance are coming on to kind of do like a listener question, but more like a guest podcaster question. And we have a bit of discussion on it. It's really cool. That said, let's get to our first segment of the day.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
I'm going to go with listener Thomas S. asks. That's another segment we have. So, Andrew, listener Thomas S. Wants to ask about this new Texas abortion burial / cremation law that just came out. We've got a few people asking us about this. I've been very curious about it, too. There's a new rule that I believe it was passed. There's a law that was passed in Texas, and I believe it's pending in the Texas Supreme Court. But is that right?
Yeah, and there's an interesting procedural aspect of this case that literally just came out an hour ago.
Oh, okay.
So I'm excited to share that with you.
So. Yeah, cool. So I was thinking I would take what I've learned from you over the months that we've been doing this and see if I could kind of guess a little bit of what the answer will be on this, or what your, you know, analysis might be. And you can tell me how I do based on this. This is like Thomas Takes the Bar, except not really. Thomas, this is like Thomas tries on having a lawyerly opinion. Like, we'll see. So this law says that if you get an abortion or even a miscarriage, that you would need to make sure that fetal or embryonic material is buried or otherwise interred. If you have an, apparently, if you have a miscarriage or abortion at home, then you're exempt from the rule. But otherwise, you have to essentially have like a funeral. Not really, but you have to bury or cremate the remains if you have an abortion or a miscarriage. Now, this sounds, of course, to me, you know my bias, everybody, I'm guessing, by now. This sounds insane. This is an idiotic thing. It goes in the category, I believe, of just things that people on the right are trying to do to make abortion harder. I think even they wouldn't argue with that. There's all kinds of laws we've talked about, the pamphlets, just all the kinds of nonsense where they're trying to make it as hard as they can within the law. So what I thought was interesting about this was that when I read this, I thought back to the episodes we've done together. Most recently, Andrew, when we talked about Planned Parenthood v. Casey, I think this really has a lot to say about that. And I thought, well, you know what? If the rule is the undue burden, I'm interested. I actually have a feeling that this will end up maybe being constitutional if it goes that far, if it goes to the Supreme Court, because I feel like they could make the case that if they come up with a way that a funeral home, or that the government's going to subsidize it, or that the hospital's going to take care of it, whatever it is, if they come up with a way to make it so that it doesn't sound like it's going to be a burden on the actual mother, then it won't be infringing on the constitutional right as established by Roe v. Wade and as modified by Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking it could end up being constitutional based on what I've learned from you. Now, here's where you tell me that the correct answer was A, which was my second choice.
I think you've got it exactly right, in the sense that what the Supreme Court is going to look at is the undue burden test from Casey that we talked about last week. And that's going to be the question, right? Is requiring a woman who has an abortion or suffers a miscarriage to undertake funereal rites an undue burden on the exercise of that right? And I certainly share your sense of pessimism that if that case comes before a Supreme Court with a Donald Trump appointed justice to fill that last spot, that could very well be the result for the reasons that you've said. The reason for optimism, to the contrary, would be in July, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case.
You talking about the Supreme Court or the Texas Supreme
Court? Supreme Court. Okay. It was a 5-3 decision in Hellerstedt. And that struck down two parts of Texas law that required stricter standards for abortion clinics, right? Like, it required the abortion clinics to meet the standards for ambulatory surgical centers, and the other part of the law required doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a hospital. And neither of those are necessary, you know, to perform an abortion, which, you know, particularly a first trimester abortion, which is a, you know, routine and legal and safe medical procedure. But again, it falls into the category of, in this case, not targeting the woman seeking an abortion, but targeting abortion providers, and basically saying, we're going to massively increase the cost, and, you know, we're going to impose all these additional requirements on you. That decision was 5-3. The four you would expect: Kagan, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Breyer in the majority, also joined by swing Justice Anthony Kennedy, and only Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, the hard right on the court, in the minority. So again, that's
so it's all, it sounds like it's going to come down to our swing justice. You know, it sounds like a lot of what you've said when you're speculating about the future of the Supreme Court, a lot rides on what he decides to do and whether or not he's more influenced by whoever the next appointee is. What do you think about that?
I think that's exactly right. And you may recall when we were in the heady days of optimism in thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to appoint the next Supreme Court justice, I thought there were clear signals in this past year that Anthony Kennedy was ready to move to the left. He's always been a reliable vote on gender equality issues. But I thought, for example, in our Second Amendment masterclass, for example, we talked about his dissent in a recent gun control case that could be interpreted as a willingness to revisit the Heller decision. I think he was sending out those signals. What he chooses to do now is anyone's guess. One of the reasons, I mean, there are lots of reasons why a justice may migrate in terms of their judicial philosophy over time. It may just be the freedom of having a lifetime appointment, and it, you know, may reflect an evolution in the thought of the justice. Also, though, I mean, lots of people are not temperamentally suited to the Scalia-Thomas role of writing angry dissents for a decade. You know, so that certainly could have been a signal of, hey, look, I want to be a part of where I think this court is going. The court's no longer going in that direction, right? Mm. And so I think the model for where the court is going over the next year or two, so long as Justice Ginsburg remains capable of serving on the court, is the past couple of years, right? Mm. And so, you know, the past couple of years have not, I would not describe the Supreme Court as an institution of transformational change, but we got the Obergefell decision, right? I mean, it was exact. So this is a very long-winded way of affirming what you said to start with it, which is, I think we're going to have a 4-4 court with four pretty liberal justices applying the standard rule of jurisprudence and four hardcore conservatives, because I am convinced that Donald Trump is going to appoint somebody from his list is a Federalist Society justice that is in the mold of a Scalia, and I think they're going to get through. And then Anthony Kennedy is going to be the swing vote, and we're going to see, you know, what happens. It's not a great outcome, but again, you know,
But does it really just – how depressing is it that it just falls on those party lines? I mean, as legal expert Andrew Torres, do you ever try to just sit and think – I know it's impossible probably for me too, for anybody. But like do you ever just think like, what should the law be? What? Forget about what I want. Forget about this. Because I just can't believe that it's 4-4 like that. You know, even though you're totally right, I think you're right that it will be. But how weird is that? You know, like it just seems like either this should make sense with what we've established the constitutional rights are – or it shouldn't. Like, it just, I don't know, that bugs me.
Well, keep in mind, we're talking about the most politically charged of Supreme Court cases, right? There are lots that are going to come up that involve, you know, sort of non-political arcane rules where there isn't a political interest involved. The other thing that I would point out that happens sometimes is justices may have a bias, but may be unable to reach a conclusion as to how to best effectuate that bias. And let me give you a real-world example of that. For a long time, and these are state Supreme Court decisions, but the principle is analogous. For a long time, the economist thought on whether to uphold a covenant not to compete, right? Which is to say, you go to work for somebody, they require you to sign a document that says, if you are fired or you quit, you can't go to work for one of our competitors for, you know, a certain length of time in a certain geographical area. Mm-hmm. And for a very long time, it was thought that the best way to be a pro-business environment was just to enforce covenants not to compete. But it's changed in recent years because, particularly in the tech sector, companies, startup companies, think about how a new tech company gets founded in your state of California. Like what happens is if it's adequately bankrolled by venture capital, that sort of thing, if it's a big investment, then they go to Google and Microsoft and hire out people who are currently working in, you know, those jobs with the promise of stock options or equity in the company, that sort of thing. And so having that kind of mobility is really essential to new business, startup, and innovation. And so what you're seeing, and obviously, you know, we're not going to drill down into the specific cases in this segment, but what you're seeing now are cases across the country where deep red state Supreme Courts are rethinking whether they want to just reflexively uphold covenants not to compete. Their bias hasn't changed, right? They still want their state to have pro-business legal interpretation of the laws. But how they get to pro business is no longer clear.
That doesn't make me feel any better. But okay.
Well, you know, we get that a lot. Like, you know, we get that a lot on Twitter, right? Like, boy, this doesn't help.
Well, yeah,
you know,
that's just how it is.
Dispensing like, therapy, yeah, you know, just yeah. dispensing not legal advice, but legal opinions.
All right. Well, there you have it. So is your prediction, do you have a prediction for what the Texas Supreme Court might do versus what the Supreme Court might do, or if it'll even get that far, I guess.
The Texas Supreme Court is going to uphold the law. That's clear. That's a partisan Supreme Court that has been conservative down the line. What I find really interesting is that today, an hour ago as we record this, a U.S. District Court judge for the Western District of Texas has issued a temporary restraining order blocking the law, has scheduled a preliminary injunction hearing for the January 3rd. And if you recall on our episode a couple of weeks ago about injunctive relief, that one of the things that in order to get injunctive relief, not only do you have to establish that there's irreparable harm, which obviously this law going into effect would constitute irreparable harm, but you have to show a likelihood of success on the merits. Mm-hmm. And so when you win an injunction, this is a district court telling the plaintiffs that in its opinion, at this stage of the litigation, that judge thinks they're likely to win on the undue burden argument before that court. And since they're not a lot of, like all of the facts that are going to be uncovered in discovery, in my view, are likely to support that finding rather than undermine it, right? Like it's just starting to trickle out, for example, that funeral homes have no procedures for burying fetal tissue prior to 20 weeks, right? Like every once in a while, you know, somebody will have a miscarriage and, you know, will very late in the term and will, you know, have funeral services or something like that. But nobody, you know, that has a first term miscarriage or an abortion, you know, has a funeral service for the tissue. So my bias, I guess, is showing here.
Yeah.
But all of the facts that are likely to be uncovered, in my view, are likely to make that case stronger rather than weaker. So I would say, number one, you've got an injunction issued, which means at least a district court judge is likely to say this is unconstitutional. Now, again, what the Fifth Circuit does, the Fifth Circuit is a pretty conservative circuit. That's not a prediction that the Fifth Circuit will uphold this district court judge's ruling, you know, but they will be bound by the facts as they come out at the district court level. And, you know, you had a Supreme Court that struck down invasive abortion restrictions in Texas just a couple months ago, 5-3. So I think there is some cause for optimism.
Right.
But,
yeah, maybe I was a little too pessimistic in my analysis.
I'm giving you that. If you had said, I think they're going to uphold it, I would have said the things you said in your analysis. I mean, it's really good. And it's going to be a close case. And anybody who says, you know, they're not sweating it out isn't thinking about it hard enough.
Right. All right. Well, there you go. I feel like I did okay. Like, can I get credit for the bar? Because I'm really needing it right now. Can I get a bonus, but maybe extra credit? How does that work? Joining us right now, our first guest in this new format. There was one for one of the early episodes, but this is the first time I think Andrew and I have both had a guest on. Very happy to be here. Cognitive Dissonance. This is Tom and Cecil, hosts of a very popular podcast called
Dissonance. What? First ones?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
can you believe how horrible our decision-making process
everybody.
Is? Yeah, exactly. But no, this is something actually kind of branching off of a little bit of what we talked about on Atheistically Speaking. We've got Tom and Cecil have really concern and curiosity about free speech issues, and something we've talked a lot about on this show because it's a contentious topic, but it's very important to what we do, obviously. But before we do that, do you guys want to say a word about your show to people who don't know? I mean,
nobody
who listens to a staid and serious show like this.
And then goes over to arguments. Cognitive Dissonance.
You're going to lose listeners. You know, like
as soon as they see what show you're on, they're like, they're going to question our decision-making process.
Exactly. Oh, let's just say.
Okay, we'll leave it in the dark.
It's like when you meet your buddy's girlfriend for the first time, you're like, oh.
Hey,
you're 60. That's interesting.
She seems. Yeah.
I want to say a couple of things in all seriousness. That like the last two episodes of Cognitive Dissonance, the interview you did with Kara Santa Maria, and then the episode that just dropped as we're recording this, which is Wednesday. I guess it dropped earlier this week.
Yeah. The Pizzagate.
Right. That both of those and your appearance on the AS300 Spectacular. I mean, you guys have really been discussing free speech issues lately, and in a way that I think is really intelligent and interesting. And, you know, we don't have to sort of go over the very basics. Like, you guys know what the First Amendment is, and we don't have to explain that that means government, you know, action. And I mean, they really have been great discussions. So
thank
you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, you guys certainly sell yourselves short oftentimes, but we're here to say it's a great show and two very intelligent hosts. That being said, let's get into it. Tom, why don't you set us up with what we wanted to talk about today?
Yeah, so this topic has come up on a number of our conversations, and what occurs to me is that we're entering kind of a new, relatively speaking, kind of a new sphere of speech, and that's speech that takes place online and through social media, and, you know, relatively speaking, this hasn't existed for very long, and, you know, free speech, or speech rather, is protected when it takes place in kind of the town square, is how I've always thought about it, right? So I can go out into a public space and I can say any crazy, offensive, nonsensical thing that I want. But what occurs to me is that social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, are they becoming more and more the de facto town square, even though they're privately owned and privately held companies? Are they becoming a kind of de facto new era town square? And if they are, being that they're privately owned and privately held, how does that or would that change speech considerations and who gets to control and moderate that speech?
Yeah, interesting.
And I'm real curious about that.
Can I put some more into it too? Because especially with how important Facebook news turned out to be with this election, you know, we're starting to see real effects of things like the bias or the spin or the filtering that Facebook wants to put on your news, just an enormous amount of control. To the point where, sure, right now, when someone says something on Facebook and they get blocked, you can say, yeah, Facebook has a policy or Twitter has a policy. They're a corporation. They have a policy. But I think it's a really interesting topic, and I like how you put it, Tom. The idea that maybe eventually it's going to be something more like the town square, more like I think of like the phone company, you know, like the phone company couldn't decide what calls you can place where and block you based on how you're talking, you know, like something where it needs to really be neutral. So I'm curious what Andrew would think about that.
I think there are a lot of really interesting issues here, and I want to really delve into kind of the justifications behind our philosophy of free speech, right? Which those philosophical justifications date back to the 17th century.
Twitter was just a startup back then.
Yeah, right. Tom and I were hanging out and, you know, just getting used to the internet back then.
Andrew's old, if you don't know the joke he's making there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I very rarely get someone who's close to my age on this show, so I'm enthused to have you on. The short answer to the question is we would have to redefine what the right to speech means. But that's not that strange of a thing to want to talk about doing, right? Like, so for example, in the late 19th, early 20th century was when we started redefining, right? That's kind of the rise of what is today, you know, modern liberalism, the modern political left, was understanding that your rights can be violated by a private company just as surely as they could be violated by the government. Prior to industrialization, the only thing that our founding fathers really considered a potential source of violating your rights was the government, because that was the only entity that was strong enough to make a difference in your life, right? And as we changed, as, you know, society modernized, this was the influence of, you know, the socialist movement, the anarchist movement, all of that, you know, we realized that, like, for the average person, it doesn't really make a difference if, you know, it's the government prohibiting you from doing something, or if it's a, you know, Henry Ford company town that's prohibiting you from doing something. Like, what you care about is, did I get to do that thing? Right. And, you know, and we really reconceived of our rights.
Interesting. So that kind of sounds like it could, you know, be something we'd need to do again eventually. Because if these companies are really If you could make the argument that they're infringing on our rights, even though, yeah, they're private companies, like, yeah, that could be something to look at.
I'm struggling to come up with a good analogy because I think that it's, you know, it's really kind of unprecedented at this point. But think about some of the transformation of rights that we've talked about and previous episodes of the show, right? Like, it used to mean the right to have a lawyer was exactly that. Like, you could, if you wanted to pay to have a lawyer be present, then you could pay to have a lawyer present. And then all of a sudden, you know, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, we realized that all of these criminal defendants who were desperately poor were showing up and being railroaded through a system and saying, you know, boy, you have the right to pay a lawyer if you want, but nobody's going to give you one on your behalf, was really undermining the purpose of that freedom in the first place. And so, you know, when the Supreme Court decided Gideon v. Wainwright, it said, yeah, in order for the right to lawyer, the right to have a lawyer to mean something, it must mean that the state will actually pay, will actually provide you with a lawyer when basic principles of liberty are on the line, right? And mm-hmm. that's why, you know, we now have that part of the, you know, Miranda warning that you know, you see on TV whenever anyone gets arrested. You have the right to a state paid for attorney to represent you in criminal processes, because we think that without that, it would just be meaningless, right? Like, you would just have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people kind of run through the system and railroaded. And that was a real, you know, change. Like, there's no question that Alexander Hamilton never, ever thought that the right to an attorney meant the right to have the government pay for your lawyer to be present. But we do now. That's changed. Mm. So could the concept of free speech, which right now means the right to be let alone by the government when you want to say something in a public place, could that change? I think this is a discussion worth having.
Based on what you said there, if private companies can infringe on our rights, then it strikes me this is more a matter of time, more a matter of when than if, because so much speech takes place online, particularly in these forums now that are, you know, widely accepted, Facebook and Twitter being the two big examples that occur to me offhand. And then, so then I wonder, as a private company, what are my options? You know what I mean? Like, how much latitude do I have as a company to decide what kinds of speech come on my platform?
Is it going to default to the seven things that you can't say on television or whatever? What are those?
Yeah,
you know, like, what I mean? Like, yeah. Whatever it is, like race, creed, whatever.
Sure, would the FCC then become, or some similar organization then become involved in regulating what kinds of speech are allowed, or,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, broadcast, so to speak. Like, I'm real curious, Andrew, to hear you speculate wildly about this.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
I think, I mean, those words are kind of the key, the operative words in that sentence, because, you know, no one knows. But the, I mean, the right analogy in my mind is the analogy to the status of newspapers, you know, in the late 18th century, right? Like, so the founding fathers were familiar with the idea that, like, private people owned companies that produced newspapers. And because of the time in which they lived, that was really, really important as a means of getting information out to people. And so, you know, we wrote a special – we wasn't around in the 18th
century. Tipped your hand. I knew it. I knew you were a super old, weird alien guy.
But the founding fathers wrote into the First Amendment a – specific protection for a kind of private enterprise. And we don't really think about that today because we think of, you know, the press and the Fourth Estate and freedom of the press. But, like, that's not a feature of other 18th century and earlier constitutions, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's a unique aspect of our country that comes from the fact that our founding fathers whipped up support for the revolution through writing pamphlets and stuff. So, you know, they kind of recognized the power that newspapers mm-hmm. had as an institution, and they wrote in specific protection for that into the Constitution in the way that made sense to them back then.
Man, you know what that makes me think of? That makes me think of, what is uh-huh. it, China, where they're blocking everything that, like, the social media, if there's dissidents, they kind of right. block what they're doing. It really makes me think of that. Like, it's very analogous to that situation.
I guess I have a little bit of a question that may sound a little bit like pushback. Here's what strikes me as a little different about a newspaper, though. Mm-hmm. A newspaper is content created by the company, provided to you, the people. Twitter or Facebook is content created by people. by the people using it. So it's the model is so much different. It's also interesting that newspaper is a big category, right? And then the Washington Post or whatever is just one of them. And there's many and they all compete. But Twitter is the only thing that's like Twitter. And Facebook's the only thing that's like Facebook. And would they all be treated in generally the same way as social media conglomerates? Would that be the right way to do that? Or would it be to say, hey, Twitter is its own medium and it's a different medium than Facebook. And it needs to be treated differently than Facebook and have different rules around Twitter's ability to regulate speech on its own platform. It's different. It's different. It's fundamentally different than newspapers, I think.
Well, I mean, let me agree with you and disagree with you in part. I mean,
focus more on the agreement.
So
I'm cutting the agreement. I'm cutting out right. The agreement just make mop the floor with them.
So where do I agree? Yes. User
okay, we can
context.
Stop there.
Yes, those are
stop it. Yes.
I'm high user five, Andrew.
Yes, high is, five. Yeah. Where's the mic? I'm dropping it.
Yes, Tom, that was a question that you asked. Now that's the end of the agreement.
But user content that is you know, disseminated peer-to-peer, obviously that's different than the, you know, mass communication one person generates and it's put out into the ether to tens of thousands or more people. But at the time, put yourself in the late 18th century, there were not a lot of options for private individuals to communicate with other people that were not, you know, sort of their friends and neighbors and family. So, you know, newspapers were indeed, I mean, there were a ton more private newspapers. And again, like, you know, the Federalist Papers were basically the celebrity Facebook of their day, right? Like the Founding Fathers wanted to disseminate to the victorious revolutionaries who were thinking about how to form a new government, like their thoughts and philosophies on, you know, what the structure of government would be like. And they used newspapers and pamphlets to do that. So,
well, that's why I thought of that analogy.
It's not that different.
Yeah, yeah. And imagine in a country, I don't have to use a specific example, but say some Middle Eastern country or somewhere where there's a very oppressive government. And you have people who are trying to express themselves on social media and they're not able to. Like, they're not. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. I could imagine, like, imagine they have a revolution. Imagine that happens and they get to write the documents, their constitution, whatever they want to do. I could imagine it being very analogous where they're like, look, the only way we could make this happen, the only way the people can gather and have their, you know, share their beliefs and be heard and all that is this social media. Therefore, we need to write this into our constitution that it's you can't ban it. You can't prevent speech. It's got to be free and open. And like, I could kind of see that as an analogy.
I mean, to me, the question is, if you're going to talk about redefining what the right to free speech means, that we would want to figure out philosophically what our concerns are, right? And so I think of a number of things, right? Like, so the historical philosophical justification for not having the government interfere with free speech is this idea that the best solution to problematic or wrong speech is more speech, right? This comes directly from John Locke. And, you know, and it was an answer to the question at the time of why should we let people say stuff that is false? And the idea, I mean, most prior to the U.S. Constitution, most governments, there was sort of a prevailing notion of, well, obviously, if people are saying things that are untrue, and the primary notion of what was untrue was, you know, things that were blasphemous, right? Like denying the obvious fact that God exists. Obviously, we should prohibit that because, you know, what value is it towards letting people just put out blasphemy? And Locke said, no, you know what? Like, there is an even greater protection of allowing people to speak, even to speak blasphemously, even to say things that are false, because, you know, you have a greater understanding of the truth, you know, produced by its collision with error. The solution to, you know, wrong speech is more speech. I mean, all of that, you know, and we've heard those kinds of philosophical justifications. And it seems like that's where the battle would be fought, right? Like, and what I heard Tom and Cecil, you guys saying on your show was we've moved into an area where the social norms of some kinds of communication, right? Like YouTube comments, those sorts of things are not, right? Like that type of speech is not fulfilling that kind of ideal, right? Like having people who just sort of like scream horrible things and racist insults when you start talking is not the kind of clash of ideas that, you know, Locke and
Bennett, you know? So you're saying the founding fathers didn't do that.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. Are you saying that the YouTube comment section of any given page is not the clash of ideas that was envisioned by John Locke?
I understand. I'm going out on a very, very big
This is why people listen to this show. They get insight that they could not have possibly thought about themselves.
This is one piece of advice you should take from a podcast.
Do not read the comments.
Exactly.
No, but I mean, like, so you have to, you have to answer the question if the reason that we have this notion of the right way to respond to speech that you don't like is with more speech. And I think,
YouTube, just to scream personal insults.
Yeah. Right. No, seriously. And so the question is, right, like, does that have any value, right? Like, is it consistent with the philosophical underpinnings of free speech to say, no, we want like some dude whose avatar is a chair to just like scream racist epithets at you? I don't know, right? Like, but that's a discussion that's worth having.
So let me ask this question. Let me flip it to a kind of a different angle. So let's say I'm a private company, right? If I'm a private newspaper and you write this hate-filled, nonsensical screed and you send it to me, I have no obligation to publish it. Right. I can say, oh, great, horrifying screed of angry, racist nonsense. I'm not going to publish it. I'm a newspaper. I have an editorial board. I get to control. The newspaper still gets to control what speech goes in their newspaper. They have almost complete unilateral control over what speech goes in their newspaper. So if we were to decide that the analogy is newspaper to something like Twitter, then there's effectively no change, right? Because Twitter right now can decide what speech by banning users, right? Sure. They can say, Cecil, you really need to stop. Buddy, nobody thought you could be that vulgar in 140 characters.
Can they do that already? Can they figure that out already?
Will you stop threatening to rape people?
Yeah. but
which is, by the way, a way in which people harass people on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
That's not I say it as a joke, but that's a thing that people do. So we're not just talking about like, hey, I think your argument is stupid. It's, hey, I want to rape you until you die.
Right.
I mean, under our current legal framework, even if those kinds of comments were in the context of government censorship, right? That is, even if we were subjecting them to the First Amendment, the First Amendment's test for whether something constitutes impermissible hate speech, right, is that it must have a substantial likelihood of leading to imminent lawless action. Right. So saying, you know, the kinds of horrible, hateful things that, you know, that you've just described, if it's not likely to lead to imminent lawless action, is still protected. We've all kind of had that discussion back and forth about whether, you know, that model makes sense or whether a more European model that is less calibrated to immediacy makes sense. But yeah, so in other words, you can say, you know, you deserve to be raped for, you know, your opinions about video games or whatever. And like, that would pass muster even in, you know, the public square context. The other thing I was going to say is that the reason behind the notion that the newspaper gets to make the call in terms of editorially what they're going to publish and what they won't is because there were very, very low barriers to entry back then to sort of start up a printing press, right? Like a printing press was a couple hundred bucks. Oh. And like, sure, you had to be landed and everything. But like the idea was if you were, you know, if your newspaper was only publishing pro-Whig commentary, then you and your fellow Democrat Republicans would purchase a printing press and start, you know, putting out all
that's
of
that's what's interesting. Yeah. Because you can't make your own Twitter. Like you can't just say, well, I'll go get my own Twitter then. Fine. Yeah.
And I think there's still that kind of view about the internet, at least among legislators, of like, you know, well, what are you talking about? Like anybody can get on the internet and do anything and put up a website. And like, that's true. But, you know, I mean, Thomas, you cut to the punchline, right? Like you can't, anybody can't start their own Twitter. Yeah. Like that's a billion dollar barrier to entry.
So let me ask this. But if, let's say Twitter gets gets sold tomorrow. And it gets sold tomorrow to Breitbart. You know, they just buy it. They just buy Twitter. They won every lottery simultaneously. They buy Twitter, right?
I think they've just already won every lottery simultaneously.
Oh, nice. And we've lost.
It just turns out that, you know, if you hire enough Russians to to win the lottery for you, you win the fucking lottery.
But I like this question. Go ahead. So they buy it.
So Breitbart buys Twitter tomorrow, right? They just, thanks, it's awesome. Now I own Twitter. And they go on and they just ban everybody that's not alt-right. They ban everybody that's not, you know, alt-right. They kick them all out. And that's that.
There's nothing we can do about it. Yeah.
Right. But then if we're talking about whether or not something like Twitter constitutes a unique space that's similar to a public square or even similar to a newspaper, you know, could we have antitrust issues? Would that be another way to consider how the uniqueness of this space gets managed?
Yeah. So there are two great questions there. So let me start with the first one. Remember that when you're making the analogy to the public square, the reason that the public square is subject to the First Amendment is because the government owns it, right? So, you know, that's a gate that swings both ways, right? Like if you're talking about, you know, do we declare something, you know, effectively a public square, that means that it is effectively owned by the government, right? And so you might have, you know, would the government step in and buy Twitter at that point because, you know, they think of it as a, you know, public asset. I mean, I don't know, but
maybe we don't go with public square. What if we go with a thing like where you have to do equal time on the major channels for elections? It's more like that?
Yeah, and let me answer that in context with the antitrust question, which I thought was really good too. And that is one of the things that is a real trend of the past 30 years, and it's true even through, you know, the Democratic presidencies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, is that we've really moved away from robust enforcement of antitrust laws, right? Like it used to be you learn in American history class about like the, you know, trust busting of the late 19th and early 20th centuries and, you know, breaking up monopolies. And the right now, our presidential part at the presidential level, our political parties have been Republicans who think that we ought not to have antitrust laws, period, and Democrats who think that it's perfectly reasonable to have multi-billion-dollar huge conglomerate mergers so long as you facilitate enough other huge conglomerate mergers to serve as a counterweight. Right?
Therefore, so Comcast now owns every single thing.
Yeah, no, it's true. And like that, all of the Comcast acquisitions happened under a Democratic president, right? Like that's not, you can't lay that at the feet of George W. Bush, right? Like that's a Barack Obama fault. You go back, I have mentioned the first legal work I did was the ExxonMobil merger, and that was approved under Bill Clinton. And the idea there was it's okay for the biggest oil company in the country to acquire the third biggest oil company in the country, so long as the second biggest oil company in the country acquired the sixth biggest oil company in the country. And there was sufficient large competition. So how does that relate to Twitter, right? If you apply our current antitrust laws, I think what they would say is, well, you know, it's okay for Breitbart to buy Twitter so long as, you know, there is a Bill Gates or somebody else out there who's ready to start a competing service.
Or they're so out of touch, they're like, well, look, MySpace is still around. Just use that.
That's really the concern I would have, right? Yeah. Is that these are guys that can't, I mean, they're like still baffled by the toaster, you know? I mean, from a technology standpoint, the legislature is not known for being on the ball with these things.
How many years or decades
are we behind in legislating, you know, against this, or not against, but through this technology too?
Unbelievably so, right? Like, I mean, what I was going to point out is it is a robust debate among lawyers right now, and I'm not making this up, whether and to what extent to allow analog cameras into the Supreme Court, right? So we're talking about they're only, what, 170 years behind the times, right?
Do they only allow pinhole cameras now?
Oh my God. They only allow...
Like you can only have a camera obscura is what you mean.
You cannot. Yeah. They will confiscate your camera obscura. I mean, like, if you've ever noticed a Supreme Court, right? Like,
they're like, we can't allow this to happen. There's going to be the big old fire, like explosion flash happening.
We just can't have that in today's court. That guy's under that cloth, you know, like that drape. Don't smile.
Well, the last time Ginsburg got her picture taken was the Civil War, so that does make sense. So,
but you notice you will never see pictures from the bench of the Supreme Court, right? Like, there's no, there are no cameras allowed in the galley while the Supreme Court is hearing oral argument. And like,
that's why you have the drawings, right?
Yeah,
and they make exactly the flip books and
And so, you know, if lawyers are wrestling with a still photography technology, right?
Wow.
Like, yeah, I don't want those. I don't want those people deciding that they know the difference between Twitter and MySpace, right? Like,
oh my God,
we're not good at that. I may be the most internet savvy lawyer on the planet.
Oh
right
my
now,
God, we're all gonna die.
Right? Yeah, we're
all screwed. Just teasing you. So, what do you think, Andrew? Then, given all these concerns, that I think they're really interesting questions that Tom and Cecil have brought up, and to add one further quick wrinkle, there's also this idea where your Facebook login is now your everything login. You know, like it logs you into every different site on the internet now. And what if Facebook decides they want to just delete your account? You know, if you don't believe the right thing. Given all these concerns, like, what do you think, as lawyer Andrew Torres, who I know is very passionate about free speech and likes how it is currently a lot? What do you think about changing how we define it, or do you think there are other ways to deal with it?
But there's a lot in that question, right? Like, to me, when I say that I consider myself a free speech absolutist or near absolutist, what I mean is that I think an aspect of a free country is that in whatever forum you want to use to communicate with someone else, that you feel as unfettered as is, you know, conceivable within, you know, sort of the boundaries of that forum to express your opinion and to not worry that that's going to have real tangible consequences in your life, right? So, for example, you know, we didn't get to talk about in this sort of brief session, because it would probably be a 3-hour detour, things like, you know, doxing people or, you know, reporting bad behavior over Twitter that gets somebody fired, right? Like, I mean, think of all of the kinds of things that, you know, we've seen that has just been sort of private to private communications, right? Taking an email forward from someone and all of a sudden, you know, that private joke that, you know, you sent to your buddy at work has now gone viral 10 million times and, you know, and people get fired over that, right? Like, all of those things, in my view, are real world consequences that are just as serious as a fine or a prohibition. I mean, if you told me, you know, I'm going to get, well, I can't get fired because I don't have a boss. But I mean, if you told me that, you know, I was going to suffer that similar kind of consequence, right? Like, that, it doesn't matter to me whether that's imposed by law or whether that's imposed by, you know, the operation of society, right? Like, that's a real consequence. And I don't know that I have an answer, but I think that it's worth sort of continuing to have this discussion and to look at it, you know, outside of the framework of the only thing that has a consequence to you is when the government does X.
Any final thoughts on the issue, you guys? What do you think?
No, I feel way more confused.
Yeah, me too. I'm so much more confused.
That's the goal.
Can we stay in? Can we stick around for the other hour and a half you're supposed to explain this in?
I would like, if you could just write it all down and then make it into a pop-up book. And then transcribe for me the pop-up book.
And then give it to his kid so he can
read
explain it
to me. All right. I can see Finn sits next to me. Dad, all right, here, look. You're not adhering to the principles of John Locke when you're saying on YouTube. All right, I'm sorry, son.
You see, Dad, when Milo loves white men very much.
Well, I mean, let me try it this way. Suppose there was no distinction of, you know, public, private. You get to write, you know, the First Amendment or the operative speech laws, you know, however you want. What would you do? I mean, you have omniscient power over the legislature and the courts. Like, how would you rewrite that? What would you do?
You see the kinds of things I have to try to answer on this show?
That's a great question.
It is.
And I don't want to spitball that. I can't believe I just
well, now
said
you
that.
You guys have homework, so get back to
I
us.
I do that.
Have wow. your Tom, have your kid write a report for us, and we'll read it on the show.
To me, One of the things that you guys have really highlighted in the past couple episodes of CogDis, which again, I plugged at the beginning of this and I'm going to plug now, they're really, really great episodes, is the degree to which social norms play into this, right? Like, and so I wonder how much of what we're trying to do is cause a change in social behavior as opposed to a change in legal behavior or alongside with the change in legal behavior. Because obviously, like, when you change the laws, you also change how people behave. But I don't know that we can solve that, you know, right now.
Well, it sounds like there's no easy answer, and that's, you know, that's okay. It doesn't have to
be
an easy answer.
Well, let's shift the conversation to gender pronouns in Canada then. Can
we do that? That's an easy answer,
Thanks for having us, Thomas.
you're out. You're just out after that. Yeah.
I'll just light that match and then walk out the door.
That's how Cecil throws up the horns. And exactly. Walks out, right.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, no easy answer, but lots of interesting issues raised. Thank you guys so much for coming on, for being our first and last guests.
I just want to say, I love this show. It is a great show. What a great mix between you two. We both, Tom and I, listen to it. We like it a lot, and it really is very informative. And I identify with Thomas all the time with all the great questions that he asks. You guys are a great couple, and it's a great show. So thanks for having us on.
And I think I'll echo that and say it's an important show right now. This is an important show.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm glad that it's out there. I'm glad that these voices are out there, because this needs to be happening.
Yeah.
Not my goofy questions, but your show needs to be happening.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much.
Sincerely, that means a lot. You know, Thomas feeling as though he got his start on your show, and I have been a fan of CogDis since before we started Opening Arguments. So I love what you guys do, and that and hearing you say those things really means a lot to me. So
yeah, thank you guys. The show, of course, is Cognitive Dissonance. Find Tom and Cecil over there. Thank you guys for being our first guests. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. It was a lot of fun.
This was great.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no. I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
All right. Time for closed arguments. Andrew, we all know about the McDonald's hot coffee lawsuit. I remember it from, you know, my childhood. I was very, very young at the time. I barely remember, actually. Let me just rub it in a few more times. Man, let me think. My mom was explaining. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. But I do remember it. And it was kind of it was a punchline. It was some crazy woman got millions of dollars because coffee was hot, you know, and it was a very easy punchline that people would say. And it was on all the late shows and all, making fun of it and all that stuff. But it's kind of been recently coming out in different sources, and I know I saw one really well-done video about how this case might not have actually been the punchline that people were making it out to be. So, Andrew, what happened? Break it down. This is a closed argument.
That's correct, right? This suit has been unfairly maligned as an example of plaintiff litigation, you know, gone mad for an awful lot of reasons. And let me just try and summarize them really, really quickly, right? So the first is the plaintiff was a 79-year-old woman who suffered third-degree burns across her entire lower body. So when you look at that, this is not like idiots of Walmart, like, oh, I spilled coffee on myself. And, you know, they really are serious injuries. If you Google McDonald coffee plaintiff injuries, don't take Google image advice from a podcast either. But if you don't believe me, look at those. And if they don't make you sick, then, you know, you have no capacity for human empathy. Number two is, you know, sort of the facts of the case. So when you go into a Starbucks, right, or a local coffee shop, and you ask for a cup of coffee, they are going to serve that to you piping hot. And piping hot is 175 Fahrenheit, which I believe is like 79 Celsius.
That's the official
Celsius
piping level, right?
It is. But that's the temperature you're going to get your coffee from Starbucks. And if you recall, like, when you get your coffee from Starbucks, like, it's really, really hot. McDonald's, this is a callback to the segment we did last week where we talked about the Ford Pinto case.
Oh.
McDonald's conducted an internal survey and they said, you know, we realize that 70%, I'm making up this number here, but we realize that say 70% of our customers order the coffee at the drive-through window. They kind of put it in their console and they drive down the road and they start drinking it 5 minutes later. And if we serve it at 175, it drops down to 150 by the time they drink it. And it feels kind of, it tastes kind of lukewarm and our coffee is kind of crappy. And so people don't like it. So if we hold the coffee at 190, then by the time they get 5 minutes down the road, the coffee is now dropped to 170, 175. It's piping hot. People like it. They're super happy. And the internal studies showed, number one, that a substantial percentage, I'm saying here 30, but don't hold me to the 30, but that a substantial percentage of their customers did drink the coffee right away.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, that 190 is way outside the norm and safe harbor guidelines for the temperature at which you should store coffee. That's I believe it's 90 Celsius for our international listeners. It is very, very close to the boiling point of water and coffee.
Yeah, that's hot.
You know, so you think about the hottest coffee you've ever had. There was an internal McDonald's directive that said, we want you to keep the coffee even hotter than that because we don't want customers complaining about it getting cold and tasting mm-hmm. crappy. When you put that together, right, that's a pretty clear case of negligence, right? Like negligence is when you owe a duty to somebody. In this case, if you're selling them a product to not deliver it in an unreasonably dangerous condition, you know what the standard of care is here. Here it is to deliver the coffee no hotter than 175. And they had an internal policy that violated it, right? So mm-hmm. that seems pretty cut and dried. Okay, they were negligent. So now then the only question becomes the damages, right? And that's where everybody sort of feels like it's egregious. The plaintiff's medical bills in this case were almost $200,000.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, because again, third degree burns over the lower half of her body and she's 79. So real and substantial medical injuries. And then the question becomes about punitive damages. And I want to sort of do a callback to OA16, where we talked about Donald Trump's habits of not paying his contractors.
Mm.
And if you remember, the lesson that sort of outraged you
yeah.
at the end of that segment was, well, if I promise to pay you $100,000 and then I don't pay you and you take me to court, then at the end of the day, the most you're going to get is either your reliance expectation.
Yeah, you couldn't damages. Sue for more right. than the $100,000, yeah. right?
Unless you could prove, you know, either that you had expended more money because of reliance, or unless you could prove fraud, which is really, really difficult to prove,
yeah.
which we talked about. So, you know, you sort of walked away from that being like, well, if you're totally unscrupulous, there's no disincentive to stop you from just screwing everybody in a mm-hmm. contract every single time you do business and forcing them to take you to court, because the worst case scenario is you have to pay what you agreed to in the first place. So do the flip side of that. If you're saying from a social perspective, we think McDonald's, we know McDonald's conducted internal surveys and said, how hot should we serve the coffee? Oh, we should serve it unreasonably dangerously hot in order to appeal to the majority of our customers, even though it's going to be a problem with, you know, a minority of our customers. And if you want to say, as a society, gosh, like, how do we make McDonald's not do that? The only thing you can do is impose punitive damages. If all they have to do is cover the actual injuries, then we're right back in the Ford Pinto situation,
yep.
right? Then their internal actuaries can say, well, you know what? Let's serve the coffee at 190.
Yeah, it's more profitable.
Right. And burn the crap out of people, and we'll pay off the actual medical injuries in the rare cases where our cars blow up or yeah, people get
our coffee
burned
blows
from the waist
up,
down yeah. or, you know, whatever. Right. If you don't want that kind of a society, if you want to be able to say, no, where it's egregious, where you know you're causing harm to someone, we want to impose punitive damages on you, then you have to have that kind of a structure. The jury awarded the punitive damages. And to the best of my knowledge, the plaintiff's lawyer said, in order to deter McDonald's, he suggested you should award punitive damages of 1 or 2 days worth of coffee sales to McDonald's across the country, which right. was then put into evidence as $1.35 million. And then the jury awarded $2.7 million in punitive damages. So on the one hand, you might look at that and say, well, gosh, this woman got a $2.7 million windfall. But on the other hand, that $2.7 million literally reflected 2 days worth of McDonald's coffee revenues, right? That's it. Yeah. And that's what we're complaining about. Like, oh, this poor, you know, billionaire corporation for having yeah. to shell out 2 days worth of coffee sales. I should also add, immediately the judge reduced the punitive damages down to just under $500,000.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So, and then the case was appealed and the parties settled out of court.
Oh, so we don't know how much.
Yeah. So the idea okay. that there were, you know, millions of dollars in punitive damages handed out to this grifter who spilled yeah. coffee on her is just, that's 100% wrong. The idea that the case represents, you know, frivolous plaintiff's litigation is, in my view, 100% wrong. There are important social objectives, you know, to be gained by awarding punitive damages. That doesn't mean that there aren't examples of plaintiff's litigation gone awry, and we've talked about some of those in the past. But
in this case, yeah, I mean, I feel like she was a bit abused by the misconceptions. She was. I felt yeah. bad once I watched that video that I watched. I hope we can do a small part to have more people sort of know what the reality of the situation was in that case, because yeah, that's pretty messed up. Yeah. She had horrible damage. It sounds like she didn't end up getting all that much more than her medical bills necessarily, but yeah, that yeah. makes sense.
So for example, one of the ways in which we could cut down on the windfall factor is to pass an excess tax on punitive damage awards. And so if you taxed punitive damage awards at, say, 80%, then, you know, you wouldn't have the problem of people saying like, oh, look, this woman just, you know, spun the wheel and won the lottery. You would still have the ability to impose a large fine on a recklessly negligent or, you know, intentionally harmful act by a major corporation so as to deter future conduct, and it would maybe cut down on the windfall factor. I don't know if that's the right way, if that's the right mechanism, but what I do know is almost every proposal that is so-called tort reform that is being pushed would, in my view, drastically swing the balance in favor of kind of the Donald Trump situation and in favor of the Ford Pinto type calculation, right? Where
yeah.
when you restrict punitive damages, just so, I mean, this would be my, you know, sort of think about this politically. When you are restricting punitive damages, when you are putting in caps, what you are saying is we do not think that it is useful for people to be able to use the courts as an instrument to deter knowingly or, you know, recklessly negligent conduct. And I don't know that that's – I don't know that people who intuitively sign up and go, yeah, it's ridiculous that, you know, that woman spilled coffee and got millions of dollars. I don't know that they're necessarily thinking, hey, I want to be aligned with the position of Donald Trump of – might as well. Like, if I'm wealthy enough, you know, might as well take every case to court. And the worst case scenario is that I'm going to owe what I owed to start with. So that would be my take.
Well, there you have it. Thanks again, as always, for breaking that down for us. And oh, we got to give a big thanks again to Tom and Cecil of Cognitive Dissonance. Check their podcast out, of course, if you haven't already. Thanks for coming on. That was really fun. But most of all, we need to thank our new patrons over at patreon.com/law. And they are Christopher Dark, Brian Masters, Adam J. Greer, Aaron Kelly, Cyrano de Bergerac's nose hair stylist. Interesting name there. Doreen, Adrian Borschoff, Eric Highland, Lachizar Nikolov, Nicholas Vroom, Randall, Robert Allman, I Spy, And actually, I wanted to call out Michael with a nice pledge edit from 10 to 11. I believe he was the one who put us through our $1,000 to a week goal. I think that was kind of funny that he decided to do that for us. I spy lowercase f.
That is lowercase f Hades, actually. Fantastic
Thank you.
Name. Yeah. Paul Hepburn, Brandon Smith, Alex McWhirter, Jason Valisek, Stephanie Schultz, Robert Carmody, Kate Anderson, Blood Cream Latte. Thanks. We're getting some Cogdis crossover. Joshua D, Tyson Bryan, Taylor Briggs, and Chrissy. Thank you all so much.
And of course, we've got to thank our Hall of Fame patrons. Roger Metcalf, Dan Irizarry, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Desecrator, Patrick Fussell, Amanda Lipnack, La Bibliotecatrice, Heather Loveridge, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Ali, or Ali, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, John Bodley, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynard, The Wayward Willis, Matthew Maxson, Grand Duke Nile, The Legormophile, Leon Hartley, and Chrissy.
And thanks as well to Hunter Ash, Kylie Reiser, Jeff S., Sakashite Fukusumi, Propanic, Philip Stromberg, Michael Schaefer, Michael, Zabby, Frederick Alstromer, Sammy, Conrad Michaels, and the Inciting Incident Podcast. We could not be where we are. We certainly would not be going to twice a week without your continued support. We really, really appreciate it. We mean that as sincerely as anything.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. And thanks for listening this week. And I guess we'll just have to see you next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.